Denver, Batch 2, Bonus Episode 1, Interview with Brent Butt. Well, a lot has happened this batch of messages, and there's a whole lot more to come, so I thought we'd jump into an interview on one of our off weeks. As you know, I'm researching behind the scenes, anything from YouTube documentaries and books to actually getting to sit down and speak with authors, experts, and enthusiasts. I'm looking for help, I'm looking for information, but most of all, I guess I'm looking for someone else who believes. In this week's interview, I was able to catch an hour of time with the Canadian comedy icon, Brent Butt. Creator and star of the hit TV shows Corner Gas and Corner Gas Animated, Brent is also a prolific stand-up comedian, and his debut novel, Huge, a dark psychological thriller, will be hitting shelves in 2023. See, I've been a big fan of Brent's for ages, and in being a fan, I knew of Brent's deep love and enthusiasm for all things Sasquatch. That's what I needed next. I've heard audio of the thing, and now I want to talk to someone who at least wants to believe Bigfoot exists. Someone that might not think I'm crazy if I told them everything. So without further ado, Brent Butt. Okay, so we will begin now. Thank you very much, Brent, for sitting down with us today to discuss all things Sasquatch.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's two of my favorite things, Sasquatch and sitting down. This is like a dream gig for me.
Now, for those that don't know Brent, Brent Butt is a comedian, actor, writer, soon to be author, or technically author, and today sitting down with us to be a Sasquatch enthusiast. So right off the bat, I do have to ask you, you are from the prairies.
I am.
Pretty far from Sasquatch country. How does somebody like you become a Sasquatch enthusiast?
I can tell you how it happened to me exactly. I remember the moment very clearly, actually. We were, my mother and father and I were at a friend's house. They lived out in a farm, and they had a kid about my age, and my father worked with this guy, so they were friends from work. Anyway, we'd gone out there for dinner. So after dinner, I'm on the floor drawing, as I was prone to do. 90% of my childhood was just drawing. And they were talking, my dad and Joe is the guy, this big, enormous man, Joe, that he worked with. He's from Hungary, and he was about 6'6". He was a huge man. Anyway, as they were talking, I was kind of overhearing their conversation, and Joe said, "Herb," that was my dad, Herb, you hear about this thing that they say is in the woods, this Sasquatch thing? It's a big, hairy thing, 10 feet tall, this thing. People are seeing it. Have you heard this?" And my dad was like, "I don't know. I haven't heard anything about that." But I was, just him saying that, I was fascinated by it. And he started to recount some of these stories that he'd heard people, you know, camping in the woods or whatever, seeing this thing. And I immediately began drawing it. It just captured my imagination. It was very Lon Chaney's werewolf looking thing that I drew. And I didn't really have a good concept of what 10 feet was. And so he was closer to like King Kong size when I drew him. I drew that Sasquatch holding a car under his arm, like you would hold a football
for scale.
So I didn't really have a good concept of what 10 feet was, but Joe was a big guy, and he sounded impressed by the size of this thing. So I thought, well, hell, if Joe thinks it's big, it's got to be pretty enormous.
How close were your drawings? How close were your drawings to what imagery you eventually saw?
Pretty far away. They were really much more like Wolfman. They really looked like 1940s Wolfman from Hollywood. But I've since, you know, because I still draw a lot, I still draw Sasquatch quite often. What, you know, notions of what it might look like.
It's fascinating. Of course, the idea of some reports saying 7 feet all the way up to 15 foot tall, hairy ape-like creature that roams the Northwest or the coasts in the woods. It's enough to capture, I guess, anyone's imagination. But you have since moved. You've made it to the coast. You've made it to the Pacific Northwest. Sasquatch country. The heart of it.
I'm in the heart of it. I'm in the thick of it.
And has that changed anything for you? I mean, you've gone from as far away as you can be from this mythical creature to moving into the heartland of where their stories have been here for hundreds of years.
It hasn't really changed anything for me. I'm still fascinated. I'm still, I'm still terrified too. Like, I'm not somebody who, like, I've been invited. People say, well, why don't you come out with us? We're going to go on a Sasquatch hunt. And I'm like, that's the exact opposite of what I want to do. I want to see film and or videotape of a Sasquatch from a safe distance. I want nothing to do with the thing. I just want him to be real.
I think that's fair.
There are so many things in the woods that I'm terrified of that are nowhere near as potentially dangerous as a Sasquatch. I'm kind of afraid of raccoons. So I don't think I would do well if I were to round the bend and come face to face with an 8 foot tall, hairy man ape. You know, my heart would just stop. Well, I wouldn't feel a moment of satisfaction of, yes, it exists. And then I would drop dead.
But worth it. Worth it all the way.
I mean, if you got to go sometime, at least going a little smug, a little happy and smug is not a bad way to go.
Well, that kind of brings me to my next topic. You're saying it would be terrifying, which is fair. Seeing a giant creature, even if it was an herbivore, would be terrifying to me. But I think am I wrong in saying that your version of it might be aggressive and vicious or territorial?
Yeah, territorial. Like it would rather avoid people if possible. But if you come rooting around into their territory, there's going to be trouble. And by all accounts, by many accounts, there's a lot of warning ahead of time. I'll give this to the Sasquatch. I appreciate that it's not just a tear your head off and ask questions later kind of situation. There's a lot of rock flinging. There's a lot of clubbing of tree trunks, whacking, like stick knocking, that kind of thing. A lot of, and then, aggressive bush rustling and yowling and things like that. So by all account, they're giving you every manner of opportunity to turn on your heel and scram. And that's up to you whether or not you have the sense to keep plowing forward as these rocks are winging by your head. Or do you go, I should maybe get the deuce out of here?
I've watched a great deal of these documentaries you can find on Amazon and YouTube of these amateur hunters. And they're exactly what I was hoping for in the people that are going out into the woods to hunt this mythical beast. A lot of them say it's to protect the cities, to protect folks, people that are scared. They're going out there to, help deal with that fear. But one thing that they kept on bringing up was the stench.
Yeah.
That for some reason in the last 30, 40 years, that has been something attributed to the Sasquatch, as though it was, we didn't see it, we didn't see tracks, we didn't hear it, but we smelt it, and that's enough. Like, they tried to add a dimension that has just been...
I think it goes back farther than that. Like, in Florida, the creature is known as the skunk ape. It's that's a longer part of the history than even some of the, early settler accounts talk about the stench, smelling it before you see it, or... That kind of thing. So it's not as new a wrinkle as you're purporting. I don't know what kind of misinformation you feel you have the right to thrust upon your listeners.
Well, it's base level research.
That's old hat. That's been around a long time. And you can imagine, I wouldn't expect, like, if I lived in the woods 24 hours a day, I wouldn't be super fussy about making sure I bathe regularly. And, you're going to have a bit of a funk, especially if you're covered in, like, you got a beard. If you don't wash your beard for a couple of days and it's got yogurt or something in there, that's got to be.
After a stew, there's residual smell.
Yeah. Never mind disemboweling a deer.
Well, half the stories I keep hearing through these documentaries are people's interaction with the victims of a Sasquatch attack. Somehow, you know, their dog, when they were hunting, scared the Sasquatch away, and they've come across the carcass of a deer or a boar with an impossible injury. But I am the product of the generation that media and movies have taught me that the Bigfoot has a chance at being charming. He's not necessarily this bloodthirsty. Right. Until I started this research, I had no idea that there was any stories of it being bloodthirsty at all. I assumed that this was the gentle giant. It was rebranded in my youth as a representative of saving our forests.
Yeah, moving in with the Hendersons, some hijinks, that kind of thing. But I think I'm going to take umbrage on behalf of the Sasquatch of your characterization of bloodthirsty, because I don't think that's the situation any more than, you know, like anything that derives part of its diet from carnivorous activity. Yeah, but I don't think it's like, when I hear the term bloodthirsty, I think more evil, like, I got to do me some killing, you know? I don't think it's that. I think it's a bloodthirsty the same way a bear would be bloodthirsty.
I'd call a bear bloodthirsty. Bloodthirsty? I stay with that. Anything that's willing to eat me is bloodthirsty in my mind. It should be treated as such.
You're projecting your want of evil on this thing.
It's not a want of evil, but it is a scary thing. Culturally, stories of hairy men of the wild have existed in every single culture. And the argument that a lot of people take is, well, they've created this scary, hairy man on the fringes of our society as a warning of what happens when you leave the society boundaries. Whereas I've always taken it as, there's this much smoke, there has to be truth, there has to be fire somewhere. These stories can't exist universally and not have some truth to them.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that, because I think that can happen. I think psychologically, I think that we, you know, as a species, share a lot of traits. Wherever you're from geographically and whatever your cultures are, I still think that we share a fair amount of similar psychological makeup. And I think that if it's inherent in some of us to create the notion of a scary, giant, hairy man thing in the woods, it wouldn't surprise me that same psychological tweak could be in other cultures and other geographical locations. So I don't know if I'm on board with you on that, but I do like there's too many reports that seem credible to me, and that's the extent of it. They seem to me to be credible, and I understand, I can appreciate this isn't going to hold water in a court of law or in any kind of scientific debate, but it seems to me there are too many plausible and believable accounts for me to dismiss it out of hand. And then when you fuel in with that the fact that I would love for it to be real, that's what puts me where I am today on this kind of precipice of belief, because I enjoy some evidence, some irrefutable evidence before I take a stand on something. But I think also psychologically, as people, we are prone to believe, we whether it's gods or whatever, we just faith of some kind. And for me, it's kind of like this, I want to believe so bad. And there is very compelling, not irrefutable, but compelling evidence to me that just keeps me right here, right in this pocket of belief.
Is it the firsthand accounts? Is it the plaster casts of feet? Is it as far back as the Patterson-Gimley film? What is it? What evidence has been enough to sustain you?
The Patterson-Gimlin film is still very compelling to me because I've seen people try to duplicate it. And like, when you see some of these footages of like the guy in the suit thing, how long does it take you to go, oh, that's a guy in a suit? Like an eighth of a second, right? And there's something about the Patterson-Gimlin film. And like biologist Grover Krantz, who was a believer in the Sasquatch, and he was an anthropology professor, I believe, University of Washington, I think. he was one of the big believers who kind of first brought a scientific background to it. Jeff Meldrum is a guy who's doing that on an ongoing basis now. And one of the things for him was he said, you know, you can always look for the elbow, shoulder to elbow to wrist ratio. And that's one of the things that always jumps out when you see a guy in a suit or a guy trying to fake the elbow shoulder wrist ratio. It takes an eighth of a second. You're like, yeah, that's
you, you immediately can smell that it's phooey.
So, you know, for this Gimlin film, Patterson-Gimlin film to be taken in the 60s and us today not be able to duplicate something that looks as real to me. And I've had friends who look at it and go, ah, it's just a guy in a suit. But I honestly feel like I'm fairly objective in this regard. And I've seen maybe a dozen guy in a suit videos. If I was prone to believe, I would think maybe half of those would be real. I've never seen one that makes me go, that looks pretty, that would be hard to fake. And I've seen people try to duplicate that exact bit of footage, even in the same, they go to Bluff Creek, they go to the same area. And, you know, in an eighth of a second, you're like, well, that looks nothing like it. That looks like a guy in a suit.
My very first viewing of the video without it being through kind of societal osmosis, when I sat down for the first time to see it, I thought immediately, this is a man in a suit, until I rewatched it. And then it became harder and harder for me to keep explaining that away. And then I watched YouTube videos of people trying to disprove it. And again, it almost every time they tried to disprove it, it made me feel like there was something more to it.
It lends it more credence. As soon as you see it compared to somebody trying to duplicate it, it really makes it seem more real. It's very, they're counterproductive. And then the other thing, there's a, I'm not sure how to say his last name, Bob Herminius, I think, is the guy who claims that he was in the suit. And they had him go out and try to do the same thing. And that was, to me, that was, he was trying to match the walk and it kind of wasn't the same. And I don't know, like it's, so anyway, to me, that's still as compelling as it gets. And then there's another piece of, you know, I wouldn't even call it, I don't even think you could call it evidence, but, and this is readily available on YouTube or other places. If you search for Sasquatch 911 call, so it's just a call to a 911 center of a guy who is, and he sounds like, you know, he sounds like kind of rural, small town hard ass who is probably not prone to being afraid.
All right.
Of anything. And he becomes, over the course of this conversation, terrified because he's calling up to say, there's something, send somebody out here. There's somebody or something running around my place. He lives on the edge of town in this rural community. And it's setting off his motion lights. And he's catching glimpses of it. And they're asking him what it is. And he doesn't want to say, I think we got a goddamn Sasquatch here, because he knows nobody's coming and I think he's a crackpot. So he won't say it. He's just saying something big. It's running on two legs. It's fast. I couldn't catch it. And they're saying, you know, have you had problems before? And he said, something killed my dog last week. And then as he's on the conversation, he loses it. It's staring at him. It's standing in the yard staring at him right now. And he's losing it. He's screaming, get somebody down here. And so it's very interesting to listen to that call, because if that guy is faking it, he should win all the awards. Like, Meryl Streep could not come anywhere near this guy's believability. This is the best actor in the world. So he's either seeing something, or he thinks he's seeing something that is giant and menacing and has killed his dog. And it's really interesting. And like I say, it's by no means evidence, because it's just a phone, there's a recording of a phone call, but it is so The hair in the back of my neck is standing up as I'm telling it to you. I keep thinking about it. And I've played it for a bunch of my friends over and over. And by the end of it, they're like, that dude is terrified. That guy is seeing something. And it's, you know, and also just from on a personal standpoint, I used to date a gal who had relatives on the island, Vancouver Island, out here on the West Coast. A lot of logging family, you know, generations of loggers. And the one guy, the kind of patriarch of the family, he was a big fella, and he was a real, like, he was a funny guy, and he was also very snarky, and he had a real, like, biting sense of humor. And if you ever said anything that was stupid, he had no qualms about roasting you, you know, quickly. And because I'm fascinated by this kind of thing, after knowing him for a couple of days, maybe, I broached the subject with him just in kind of a, I said, listen, you know, you've been in the logging industry and you've been living in the woods your whole life and everything. I said, what do you think about the, you hear these reports of Sasquatch and Bigfoot? And I kind of put it to him in a real, you know, kind of neutral way. And he, it was like I was asking him about the weather. He said, well, there's something out there. He said, I've never seen anything myself. I know guys who've worked with have seen stuff. And, you know, you hear things. And he said, I've never seen anything, but I've heard stuff I can't explain. And I know some pretty stand-up guys who don't scare easy, who have come out of the woods terrified a few times. So he said, I think there's something to it. There's something out there. He just said it so, it wasn't like he was trying to jerk my chain or any, and he didn't, if he didn't think there was something out there, he would have roasted me. I have no question about it. And he just took it so matter-of-factly that always stuck with me. Just the fact that he said, yeah, there's something out there.
There is something about a survivor of an incident of, you know, a viewing, a sighting, a hearing, that when they're so sincere about it, I'm happy I'm not, you know, traveling the coast interviewing people to talk about the Sasquatch, because every single story would prevent me from ever going back into the woods. I believe people who believe. I find it very compelling. I find it difficult to look somebody in the eye who truly believes something and call them a liar. And so many of these stories, you know, involve people that truly believe what they saw. The person on the phone, whether he's seen a Sasquatch or not, he believes what he is seeing.
Yeah.
Is this great, this great ape.
And the fact too, that he did not want to say that it was not a person, but they can't. And so they're saying to, are you saying it's a person, sir? And he's like, well, it's, he's really big. It's really, he's, and there's, they're saying, is it a white man or a black man? He says, he's all in black. He's all, and they're like, he's dressed in black. I just see, like, he doesn't know how to, he doesn't want to frame this in a way that won't get him help. And you can tell, he's like, if I say I'm looking at a Bigfoot, they're not going to send anybody and I'm terrified. So he's just saying it's a big guy. He's like 6'9" or something. I don't know.
Send people with guns.
Yeah. And he, when he sees that, and one of the things that makes me laugh in it too, is the, because he's getting more and more scared. And then when he freaks out, when he sees something, get somebody out here right now. And she's like, what? The operator's like, why? What's, he goes, it's here right now. It's looking at me. And you hear her go, uh-oh. That I wait for that every time I listen to it, because it just in the milieu of the terror that's going on, just have somebody go, uh-oh, cracks me up.
I have difficulty if given the opportunity to talk to somebody on the 911 while looking at a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch, I would have difficulty believing what I've seen, because it does feel so unnatural. I would have that, not even fear for not getting help, but I've had fear of sounding ridiculous. You know, yeah. Could it possibly be what I'm seeing? Do I just not know what a bear looks like? Is this just my first bear experience?
Yeah, that's the thing too. And then, so there are a number of reports from people who, you know, have hunted bear their whole life. And they're like, no, don't tell me this was a bear. I know every move that a bear makes. I'm very familiar with it. Right. So, yeah, you get those people that have just experienced woods people who've lived their whole life and have hunted. And, yeah, they're seeing something they don't understand or can't explain.
With your travels, you've traveled to every remote part of Canada where these stories are, I guess, richer. Have you ever interacted with somebody who had their own personal, let me sit you down and tell you about the time I was in the woods story?
Yeah. And a couple of times, and they're never anything too dramatic. It's never like, you know, I never had anybody tell me that they were, you know, pursued or anything like that. You hear some of these stories in person. I've only ever talked to two people who said they saw something that they don't know what it was. It just seemed like, you know, big, dark, no clothes, moving through the woods. So nothing too dramatic and nothing that you would go, well, that's a load of crap, right? It's very within the parameters of believability, certainly.
It's a difficult science, cryptozoology, because so many people are doing genuine research, trying their very best to prove whether or not these animals exist, but they have to contend with a huge amount of hoaxes and pranks and fakes that other sciences and other studies don't really have to deal with. You know, there's very rare that an anthropologist had to find this small village, but there were six fake villages around it to kind of mislead you about exactly what that culture is.
So when I talk about like Grover Krantz or Jeff Meldrum, who are accredited scientists, you have to kind of, and there's no way without knowing them, like how much are you fueled by your desire to believe? There was a great case that was, it was kind of fascinating and in a weird way. I felt bad for the guy. I can't remember his name. This has to do with UFOs though. And he was a professor at Harvard, I think. And he believed that he had, you know, with all his heart, that people were being abducted by aliens and going through this similar experience. And he was saying that there was one of the things that he used to back up his belief in all this was that he would talk to them and they were hypnotized. So they couldn't be lying to him because he had them hypnotized. So they absolutely believed what they were saying. And then their stories were so similar, yet they didn't know each other. There's no way they could have similar stories. And anyway, he started interviewing this one woman who claimed to have been abducted. He hypnotized her. She told him what happened. It fell all within the same parameters of the stories of other people that he, and he was giving a lecture to other professors, I think. I can't remember who the lecture was. Anyway, he brought this woman along because she was basically the person that he was talking to most recently and the most believable. And he brought her as evidence. And as he introduced her, she came up to speak when he introduced her. And she basically said, yeah, I'm making it all up. I'm a reporter from such and such magazine or such and such newspaper. And I'd been hearing these stories and him saying it would be impossible to fake about it. So I just thought, well, I'll see how far could I get away with faking this guy out? And sadly, he just bought it hook, line, and sinker. And it, of course, humiliating for him. So, you know, being accredited only goes so far, I think. That's why I feel it's more compelling to me. Like, it's interesting when you get like an academic who has sound, reasoned arguments to back up your belief, the thing you want to be true. That's very comforting in a way, but you do have to be, logical about it. And that's why for whatever reason, it hits me much more when you talk to somebody that's just like a regular Joe going about their business, nothing to gain. And they just tell you something that's really compelling and creepy and weird.
Sometimes it's when you talk about aliens, you know, there's enough scientists out there who will tell you, well, mathematically, let me explain to you why there has to be aliens.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But that'll never feel as good. It'll never, you know, taste as good as somebody who says, oh, I've had a close encounter of the first kind and I can tell you what they feel like. You know, that's always going to feel like it has more meat on the bones than the theoretical professor who's refusing to quite pick a side.
Yeah. I mean, as humans, nothing compels us more than story. It's one of the things that has, you know, driven us from the days when we were living in the caves, when we climbed down from the trees for the first time. Stories has been a part of our culture, and they resonate with us. And it's why, you know, here we are in 2022, we're still buying books and watching movies. And, you know, because story, for whatever reason, is, it should almost be in that, you know, the hierarchy of need, where it's like, you know, the top five, where it's like oxygen, water, food, shelter, whatever, procreation, whatever those five.
It's Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
I think the story needs to be in there. Maybe not in the top five, but I think if we don't have stories in our life, we rot as humans. It's so, and it's one of the things that you know, drives us around the bend too. Like, people will buy into stories. They'll hear a story and believe it and buy into it, you know, so deeply. Because it's kind of ingrained in us. So there's never going to be any kind of academic intellectualizing that's going to carry the same weight as like somebody in a dark corner of a, you know,
I want to see the scar. I want to see somebody in a shady bar pull up their sleeve and show me the scar from their interaction.
Yeah.
I want one of those moments. Cause I guess this is the next question. If you don't believe already, what evidence would it take for you who wants to believe it? What evidence would you have to see personally to flip that switch in the brain to say it? Okay, it's real.
Yeah, I would probably need to see, like, I could be brought on board 100% with video evidence that had been analyzed by people who create fakery, you know. And if somebody was out in the woods and they had clear video footage of a large hairy creature. So you're seeing what you think you're seeing. And then that video is then analyzed by the top experts in the field of digital fakery to look at that and say, yeah, no, I know how to make a fake, and that's not it. At that point, I would be, you know, I'm already so close anyway. It would take very little of a push to get me there. But that kind of, I think that would, you know, I always try to be somewhat logical and you know, be, I don't even know if skeptical is the right word for me, but you want to be, you know,
responsible.
I don't want to
be just, in your
responsible. That's the perfect word. I want to be responsible in my belief system. And that would do it for me. I don't need to, let me stress this again. I don't need to be in the woods seeing the thing come face to face with it. I don't want that to happen. I will never go on a Sasquatch hunt. I will never be on Finding Bigfoot, that show.
Genuinely, one of my questions was if you'd ever be compelled or could be compelled. But you see it as a dangerous wild animal. And yeah. I have no desire to go swimming with sharks either.
Yeah, same. I'm with you.
It's their house.
In this amazing age when we can sit back in the comfort of our TV and watch, you know, of our home, watch it on TV. That's good enough for me. I don't want, yeah. It's like, to me, it's like, hey, why don't we go out and have a gunfight? Wouldn't that be fun? No, would not be fun at all. Why? We could get hurt. Something bad could happen. That's how I feel about Sasquatch hunting. No, thank you.
The best case scenario is arguably the most dangerous part of it. You know, the best thing you could hope for is coming face to face with this creature. And I'm not willing to do things where the best case scenario could be death.
Yeah. And also, I feel like even if things didn't go sideways, so you're out there in your little pup tent and it's 3 a.m. and you hear some rustling and you open up the flap, you know, the tent, you peek outside and you see this monstrous hairy thing eyeballing your tent. And then it walks away. I don't know that wouldn't just drive me around the bend, like send me into madness just for the rest of my life going, did I see what I thought I saw? And it would certainly terrify me. My blood would run cold and, I don't need that. I have enough, excitement.
As a child, I remember being in the bathroom at home alone and another door in the house shut. and it affects me still to this day that I can't explain it. My dog was in the bathroom with me, and I'll never be able to understand exactly what happened. Hopefully it was a breeze, but it's enough of an unknown that it, you know, it'll stick with me. And
Did you stay in the bathroom for a long time? Afraid to go out?
No. It was more stomach stuff, but yeah, I was in there for a bit.
No, but I mean, like, after hearing the noise.
Yes, I heard the noise and stayed in fear, looked at my small Lhasa Apso dog who was in there with me, and we waited. And then I went around the house looking for what could have shut the door, but no windows were open. And then I went to a friend's house because I was genuinely uncomfortable of not being able to explain this thing that had happened. And I am truly a skeptic. I have to see it to believe it. And an unknown.
How old were you at this time? How old?
13 or 14. I was in middle school, and old enough to be home alone, but I was a very small child. So it took till I was 13 or 14 till that was allowed. And then, yeah, sat down and the door shut in the room and somewhere in the house.
Did you share this story with family immediately upon their coming back home?
Absolutely. And they said, you're just scared. You're hearing things. It's right. The wind. There's logical things to explain what happened. And that's enough for me. Adults told me it was not to be scared of. And so I was not scared of it. Thankfully, I don't traverse the woods. I'm no love of hiking. I'm very much an indoor cat. So I don't have those stories of hearing something in the woods I can't explain that I'll then have to carry with me forever.
Yeah, I remember how terrified I was when I was in a camper van with a buddy and his mom camping, and a bear was, you know, we could hear a bear was rummaging around outside, probably just a small black bear. But knowing what it was, you know, without the mystery element of it, completely terrified. So if you take that and compound the, I don't know exactly what's happening on top of that, I'm not built to deal with that level of fear. You know, I always laughed at the no fear t-shirts. I was like, wow, we are very different, you and I. I used to do a bit in my stand-up about that shirt, about the no fear. Like it's don't be proud of that. We're supposed to be afraid of things. The only way you can have no fear is no brain, right? That's the only, we're supposed to, as a species, we're supposed to be afraid of things. It's how we advance. It's why we don't run headlong into a train. Fear is good.
Fear is healthy.
But you know, here's the other thing is that, because I'm kind of, I'm generally interested in the paranormal. This particular window, the Sasquatch, has really snagged the bulk of my attention. And I am terrified of the notion of being in the woods with this thing. You could it would be much easier for you to convince me to sleep in a supposed haunted house. You know, like if you can spend the night in this haunted house, we'll give you 10 grand or whatever those contests are. You know, I wouldn't be in a rush to do it, but it doesn't terrify me on any level the same way as going in the woods where a Sasquatch might be.
Well, that's fair. I'm not afraid of ghosts, whether they exist or not, because I'm definitely in the hierarchy of fears. I put people above them. So me being trapped in a haunted house, I think my instinct will still be, I hope there's no people in here with me. I think in the woods, even your best case scenario of it's not a Sasquatch, there's enough dangers in the woods. There's reason why we have these morality stories to keep us out of the woods, going beyond the peripheries of society.
I have kind of a theory, and I don't know. I've done a little research to see if anybody else has kind of thought of this. I haven't seen it anywhere. If any of your listeners have seen this or track it down, it would be great to read. I've always had this notion of the legend of the werewolf coming from being rooted in Sasquatch, where it was in a land, you know, the notion of the werewolf comes from a place where when gorillas and apes weren't really known. And so if you had to give it a framework, you'd say it was like part man, part wolf. You'd probably go wolf, right? You're like, what biggish hairy thing is out there in the woods? But it's walking around like a man. So it's part man, part wolf. I've often wondered if that's where the legend of the werewolf comes from, is people seeing kind of a Sasquatch type creature, you know, 1,000 years ago.
It's rooted in the same thing, the idea of a wild man.
Yeah.
Right. And if you, you know, up until the early 1900s, gorillas were thought to be a myth to Europe. They were still a mythical creature of these men, hairy men that walked the woods. It makes sense that your version of wild at that point would have been wolves and dogs. And, you know, a hybrid between wild and man is what we are seeing. And that's what we're afraid of. How can this exist without the rules of our society?
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know. I'm sure I'm not the first genius to stitch this theory together. So, but I've tried to see if there's anything written on it, but nothing I've found.
See, this is where we start coming into my ignorance. Are there stories involving the Sasquatch? So I've heard stories of some people say, you know, some First Nations to believe the Sasquatch to be a mythical being that can come and go from different realms. There's people who've said, oh no, the Sasquatch are actually aliens. They've been here for a while, dropped off by aliens. And then there's people who say this is an unknown creature. Are there stories about the Sasquatch that has it compared to a man converted, a man gone wild?
Not that I've ever heard. I mean, I've heard these theories about like what, I've also heard that humans were the offspring of Sasquatch and alien. I've heard people say that too. Like, and visually you go, oh, I see why you go there. Cause you take the big hairy, you know, the big thing covered in hair, and you take the tiny little thing with no hair. What would you, if you put those two together, oh, a medium sized thing with a little bit of hair.
Well, the math checks out.
It checks out. I don't know what more proof you need.
So if the Sasquatch does exist, let's say in this moment, Sasquatch exists, has been here, all the stories true. Which way do you lean? Is it an animal bred of Earth? Is it something supernatural?
No, it's absolutely a natural thing that has just been, you know, the predisposition to avoid humans. Like one of the anthropological, you know, science-y kind of theories about Sasquatch, because we know there was a giant ape called Gigantopithecus Blackeye. There's some argument about how giant this giant ape was, but there's no getting around it. All consensus is it a pretty big ape. So Gigantopithecus Blackeye, sharing the same food sources as Homo sapien, but Homo sapien having the bigger brain and the ability to create weapons and use artillery in the battle, chased the giant ape up into the mountains. And they, you know, generations, hundreds and hundreds of years, maybe 1,000 years of Gigantopithecus Blackeye and Homo sapiens battling for the same turf led the Gigantopithecus to develop a natural aversion, just avoid humans, and they trucked up into the mountains. And to this day, they have an inherent, you know, a want to avoid humans. And this is their turf. So they're very, very good at it. They can hide and be and go unseen. And if you just look at the, because one of the things that I always shake my head at when, if somebody ever finds out that I'm interested in Sasquatch and that kind of thing, sometimes you'll get people who are really like, you're a moron for thinking of it, you know? And they'll say, I've heard this from a number of people. They say, well, we've been everywhere in this. There's no uncharted territory. You go, like, how can you walk around and be that dopey? Like, if you just, I always use this as an example. If you just fly between Vancouver and Calgary, the two largest Western cities, just in that, and you only look at what you can see out the your airplane window, which is not a big window, you're looking at you know, millions of square miles of thick bush that has never had a human foot on it in the history of the planet. The vast majority of that dirt has never had a human walk on it. If something was smart and wanted to hide and was good in the woods, it would be incredibly easy to live undetected. You know, there are, I can't remember how many, somebody said, somebody told me one time, or I read one time, how many large, shiny aircrafts have crashed between Vancouver and Seattle, and how few of those have ever been discovered. So we're talking about something, you know, something 80 to 100 feet long or more, this shiny metal. Can't find it. We have metal detecting equipment. Can't find it.
So if satellites everywhere, can't find it.
8 feet covered in hair and good at hiding, I really like your chances.
Well, thank you very much for chatting.
Well, I'm happy that we were able to prove it here today, beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Well, it's refreshing to talk to. It's nice to talk to a skeptic and be warmed by the idea that, you know what, you're right. Not enough evidence for me to prove it. But then when I talk to an enthusiast, it feels more exciting. It feels like the better party to be a part of is the. Yeah,
it's more fun to believe. That's for sure.
It's scary, and I agree that I never want to interact with one face to face. But it's definitely not conclusive.
Yeah, that's where I'm at too. I want very much for it to be real, but I can't put myself in the category of believer. But I've yet to hear anybody give me any evidence that makes me go, "Oh, you're right. It is impossible." And as long as I have that window, I'm in the camp of like, yeah, I'll read everything that comes down the pike.
A few great takeaways and even more questions, but overall, incredibly pleased that I had the opportunity to sit down with Brent. I learned a lot, and it was nice to talk about Bigfoot with some levity for a change, you know, as opposed to having to hear him rip Palmer in half. Did Brent give me every answer I wanted? No. In fact, he even made me challenge some of what I thought I knew. I mean, why does this Bigfoot behave differently than the stories we hear? Noah and Sarah didn't mention the smell, and they would have, and nowhere in my research does it mention that he speaks. I'll have to dive a little deeper, I guess. Thank you to Brent Butt for carving out some time with us, and if you want to keep up to date with what he's doing, at Brent Butt on Twitter and Instagram, and on YouTube at The Butt Pod. If you have a Bigfoot story or encounter, I would love to hear about it. Shoot me an email at escapingdenverpod@gmail.com, and I'll be back next week with another episode of Escaping Denver.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.